Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
I am so glad you're here. This is Avery After Dark, and I'm your host, Avery Ross. And boy, oh boy, do I have a scary story for you. This is terrifying. A nightmare. A family moves into an isolated rental house in rural Alabama, hoping for a fresh start. But the moment they step inside, they realize something is very wrong. The previous tenants appear to have left in a hurry. Personal belongings and furniture are scattered throughout the house. And mysteriously, every single mirror in the house has been ripped from the walls. And before long, the family begins to feel a presence. Strange noises. The feeling of being watched. Terrifying encounters that leave them questioning whether they're truly alone in their new home. But things get even stranger when the family learns who once lived there. This wasn't just any old country house. So I want you to get cozy, grab a blankie and some snacks, because tonight we're traveling to Alabama for one of the creepiest hauntings in history. This is the haunting of the Voodoo House. In 1971, Harper Lee, the acclaimed author of To Kill a Mockingbird, set out to write what many believed would be her next major book. But this time, it wasn't fiction. Harper Lee became fascinated by a bizarre and controversial case unfolding in rural Alabama. At the center of it, a mysterious preacher from the tiny town of Rockford, a man surrounded by rumors, suspicion, and a string of mysterious deaths. She spent a lot of time researching the story, conducting interviews, digging through records, talking with locals. Yet strangely, for reasons that remain unclear, the book was never published. To this day, no one knows exactly what happened to Harper Lee's long-rumored true crime manuscript or why she ultimately walked away from the project. More than 40 years later, another woman would find herself pulled into the same story. Fast forward to 2012. Jenny Scott was working as a journalist for a local paper in Auburn, Alabama, where she had lived for nearly a decade. But she was saying goodbye to this life and moving out to the country. Her husband, Hunter, got a new job opportunity which paid more, but it also meant they needed to move closer to his job. Hunter described this job as almost a can't-turn-down type of situation, his big chance. But for Jenny, she enjoyed her job as a journalist. This was going to be a big change. She was now going to be a stay-at-home mom, but they really believe this move will be great for their family. They picture in their minds this country house being peaceful and quiet, an ideal place to raise their kids. The couple had a young daughter named Grayson and also a cute little dog named Betty Lou. So they packed up their life into their truck and made the move. Both Jenny and Hunter had children from previous marriages. Jenny had a son named Buddy who was 9, and Hunter had a daughter named Faith who was also 9. Their new house was located in central Alabama, a town named Rockford. Rockford is a kind of small southern town where life moves at a slower pace. It is small with just a few hundred residents. quiet country roads, and a dense stretch of woods surrounding the community. It really is the type of place where everyone seems to know everyone. Historic homes, aging churches, and generations of local families make the town feel timeless, as though little has changed in decades. But for a family relocating from the college town of Auburn, Rockford felt like stepping into a different world. No more busy streets, football crowds, or constant activity. This new life was going to consist of dark rural nights, sounds of insects echoing through the trees, and miles of farms and countryside where the nearest neighbor will be out of sight. As Jenny and the family drove to the new house, one that Jenny had not seen yet, she kind of got nervous, saying they were really out in the middle of nowhere. When they pulled up, it looked idyllic. It was a really big white farmhouse. Hunter had found this house to rent, and when they're first getting out of the car, Jenny is really impressed with her husband and thought this place looked too good to be true. What's the catch here? How could they even afford this house? As Jenny looks out, all she can see are fields for miles, no neighbors. They are very isolated out here. Hunter's telling Jenny, "Yeah, I got this house at a great price." As soon as they step foot inside, it quickly became clear why this place was such a bargain. It was a wreck. It looked like the previous residents left in a hurry, as there is furniture and personal items everywhere. It gets even creepier as they walk upstairs to the second floor, and they're shocked. They see the walls are splattered and covered with blue paint. There is blue paint everywhere. It's like someone took a paintbrush, stuck it in a bucket of blue paint, and flung it all over the walls chaotically. The window frames are covered, so are the light switches. It's eerie. But Jenny is really trying to put on a happy face for her husband, although inside she's wondering what she has agreed to. And then she begins to look around and notice something strange. She sees the mirror had been removed from the bathroom wall. And then she realizes she hasn't seen a single mirror in the entire house. They had all been ripped from the walls. Very weird. The family continues to explore the second floor. Jenny is in the hallway and looks up and sees that the door to the attic above is sealed shut with duct tape. It is covered in blue tape. The attic door is wrapped in it. Jenny grabs a chair, climbs up, and begins ripping down this duct tape. She yanks it down, wanting to see, why is this taped? Is it broken? Is there something up in this attic that they need to be aware of? By the way it's wrapped in this tape, it looked like someone didn't want that attic to be used for whatever reason. They just didn't know why. So Jenny gets all the tape off, pulls down the attic door, and sees that the door isn't broken. It works fine. She slowly pops her head in and looks around and sees a very dirty, dark old attic, but that's all she can see. They don't understand why it was taped shut, though. But they close the attic door and continue looking through their new house and decide they're going to stick it out. Sure, there's going to be a lot of work to do, but they decide they're going to stick it out here. Shortly after moving in, Hunter is off to start his new job. But to make things even more isolating for Jenny, the couple only has one car and Hunter takes it to work every day, so Jenny and their daughter are at this isolated farmhouse alone. But determined to make the best of it, Jenny continues looking around and finds that the house has intercoms in every room, which could play music. The vibe of the house so far is pretty eerie, so Jenny turns on some classical music that can play throughout the entire house. And during these days, this makes her feel more at home. But the reality is, she didn't feel at home. Because almost instantly, Jenny says she begins to get this feeling like she's being watched. One night, Hunter is working late. Their daughter is asleep, and Jenny's starting to get that really uncomfortable feeling. She's looking out the windows, and there isn't anything. It's just country. All around this house is just pitch black. Nothing but farms in every direction. And remember, there's no neighbors around. This isn't a subdivision. She can't socialize with anybody. They're all alone. Not loving how this is feeling, Jenny decides she's going to head to bed. And as she's trying to get their dog, Betty Lou, to come upstairs with her, she notices that Betty Lou is like, uh-uh. Their dog is refusing to go upstairs. Even when Jenny picks her up and physically brings her upstairs, as soon as she puts her back down, Betty Lou takes off in a sprint back down the stairs. Jenny had never seen Betty Lou act like this ever. She decides to get in bed and starts reading a book. She's sitting there for a few minutes when she starts to hear movement outside her window, like a shuffling, scurrying sound. She gets up, looks out her bedroom window, thinking it's got to be some kind of animal. They were out in the country. But the thing was, they had a motion sensor light around their house, and whatever it was that was moving around out there didn't set that thing off. Jenny locks the windows, gets back in bed, but continues to hear this scurrying sound for the rest of the night.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
If you like your true crime like you like your coffee,
Red Handed is the podcast for you.
It's dark, intense, and might just keep you up all night.
I'm Hannah.
I'm Saruti. And every week on Red Handed, we break down a different fascinating case.
From the most recent US trials everyone is obsessing over, like Brendan Banfield, Karen Reed, and Ellen Greenberg,
to the most unbelievable stories from around the world, there's nothing we love more than digging into every detail of the cases we cover, getting beyond a basic analysis and cutting to the heart of the story.
Red Handed has over 400 episodes ready to binge right now.
Plus, be sure to check out our weekly sister show, Shorthand, where we unpack everything from the Black Death to Area 51.
If you're looking for smart, detailed true crime with personality, check out Red Handed wherever you get your podcasts.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Jenny turns her focus into fixing up the house. The couple's children from previous marriages, Buddy and Faith, come to stay at the house for the first time, and so Jenny got all the rooms ready for them, decorating, really wanting the kids to feel at home there. And that first night, everyone's together, and it's great. Hunter, Jenny are really excited that the house feels full of life. Kids are laughing, playing, having fun. But this feeling of comfort was short-lived. Later that night, after dinner, Jenny and Buddy are in the bathroom. Jenny is preparing a bath for him, and she looks over and sees that Buddy is mesmerized, fixated on the new mirror in the bathroom. She's watching him and he keeps looking closer and closer. And then suddenly he flies back screaming. Jenny runs over and asks Buddy what he saw, what happened. Buddy is obviously terrified, but he won't tell his mom what he saw in the mirror. But whatever it was bad. At this exact same time, Hunter is getting Faith ready for bed in her new bedroom, one they fixed up for her. When all of a sudden they look down and see it's been infested with swarms and swarms of cockroaches. They are everywhere, on the beds, windows. It started as a really nice night, but this quickly turned terrifying. Buddy is horrified by what he saw in the mirror, and Faith is so uncomfortable. Her room covered in cockroaches. Ugh. After that weekend, Buddy and Faith went back to the city. A few days later, Jenny is at the house. Grayson is upstairs asleep, and she's in the kitchen doing dishes. As she's doing her chores, she has the music system playing nice classical music through the house. when suddenly she's overwhelmed with that feeling of unease, like someone is standing right behind her, watching her. And as always, she turns around and sees nobody. Then, without warning, the music suddenly changes to loud screaming death metal, blaring over every speaker in every room of the house. Scared, Jenny runs over to the main panel, but the music will not turn off. She's trying every knob. She's turning down the volume, turning the entire system off. But this heavy death metal continues to blare at the highest volume. Not sure what to do, Jenny calls Hunter at work, and he can hear the music blasting. Finally, desperate, Jenny reaches in and pulls out the panel, disconnecting the lines and the cords. Finally, the music shuts off. But as soon as it does, she can hear something upstairs. A creaking sound. It's loud and heavy enough. It sounds like someone's walking around up there. And this wouldn't be her young daughter, as she wasn't heavy enough. She was little. She whispers to Hunter, "I think there's someone in the house." And Hunter says, "There's no one in the house." But Jenny knows someone is up there. So she runs over, grabs a knitting needle, and quickly makes her way up the stairs, immediately checking her daughter's room to see her daughter is fine, but follows the creaking sound down the hall into the room at the very end. She looks everywhere, behind curtains, in closets, but there's no one there. It's around this time that Jenny is sure of one thing. This house is haunted, and whatever is there does not want her family there. After Hunter gets home from work, she tells him about what happened and says that she believes there's something paranormal going on here. But Hunter does not believe her. She's really upset by this and screams at him, "I gave up everything for you." Because she did. She had a job. She had a city that she enjoyed living in. She had a life in Auburn for years. And this is sad to me because she is in this house out in the country, isolated. Especially having no neighbors nearby, no car. It is just her and her daughter most of the time. And there are some really strange things going on in this house. They haven't even been there that long. I can't imagine being trapped in the middle of nowhere in an old haunted house with no ride, no car to get out if you need to. So you're dealing with all this activity, and meanwhile, you have no friends or family nearby. As time goes by, Jenny said it felt like she and Hunter were leading very different lives. He is busy with his new job, this big opportunity, and he's gone a lot. And Jenny is just scared and alone, so she reaches out to her friend, a woman named Kim. She invites Kim to see the new house and visit her. She's really wanting someone to be there for her. Kim happily agrees. The day of the visit comes, and the second that Kim pulls up and gets out of the car, instantly, she's like, "Yeah, there's something really weird with this place." Kim said that the house had an odd energy and was uncomfortable just in the front yard. As Kim pulled up to the house, Jenny and Grayson were outside in the side yard area. And Hunter is gone at work. And as Kim is staring at the house, looking up at it, she sees a dark shadow figure walk past a window on the second story. The two women get to talking about the house, and Jenny shows Kim photos she took of the blue paint all over the walls before she repainted. Kim looks and says, "I've seen this before. It's used in voodoo. It's called haint blue." This unusual tradition is found throughout the American South, the use of haint blue paint. And even today, this can be seen on porch ceilings, shutters, window frames, and even doors of older homes, and is a collection of shades of blue and green. And according to Southern folklore, the practice originated among the Gullah Geechee people of the coastal Southeast. The word haint is a regional term for a restless ghost or evil spirit And it was believed that painting parts of a house blue could confuse or repel these supernatural entities. Why? Well, some legends claim that spirits could not cross water, and because the color resembled the sky or water, Haint would mistake the painted surface for a barrier and pass by the home altogether. Over time, this tradition really spread throughout the South, including parts of Alabama, Georgia, and the Carolinas. Many homeowners today use Haint blue simply because they like the color. But some continue to practice this as a nod to old folklore and the belief that it offers protection from wandering or evil spirits. And so Kim is looking at these photos and recognizes this Haint blue from spending time in New Orleans with her mother. Jenny tells Kim about all the unexplainable things that have happened in the house since moving in, telling her that when they first moved in, all the mirrors had been ripped down from the walls and removed from the home. She tells Kim about feeling watched, the footsteps, the swarms of cockroaches, Buddy seeing something in the mirror, and just the all-around feeling of isolation in this home. Jenny tells Kim, "I believe the house is haunted," and Kim is a historical researcher. So they agreed, maybe the two can figure out what was going on in this house together. Kim leaves the house that day, telling Jenny, "Okay, I'm going to start looking into some stuff. Let's keep in touch."
If you like your true crime, like you like your coffee,
Red Handed is the podcast for you.
It's dark, intense, and might just keep you up all night.
I'm Hannah.
I'm Saruti. And every week on Red Handed, we break down a different fascinating case.
From the most recent US trials everyone is obsessing over, like Brendan Banfield, Karen Reed, and Ellen Greenberg,
to the most unbelievable stories from around the world, there's nothing we love more than digging into every detail of the cases we cover, getting beyond a basic analysis and cutting to the heart of the story.
Red Handed has over 400 episodes ready to binge right now.
Plus, be sure to check out our weekly sister show, Shorthand, where we unpack everything from the Black Death to Area 51.
If you're looking for smart, detailed true crime with personality, check out Red Handed wherever you get your podcasts.
Up until this point, Jenny is alone in her belief that the house is haunted. Until finally, one night, Hunter has an encounter in the home. Hunter would work late a lot, as we've heard. So many nights, it was just Jenny at home. One night, Hunter worked late and got home to find the house completely quiet. Jenny is already asleep upstairs, and so is their daughter, so he decides to sit down and watch some TV downstairs for a bit. Sitting there for a few minutes, when right in his ear, he hears Jenny's voice calling his name. Hunter. Hunter. And then louder, right there as if she is standing right behind him. He jumps up, looks around, and there's no one around. But he's so sure that Jenny is pulling a prank on him. He goes upstairs, looks into the bedroom, and sees Jenny sleeping. But he thinks she's fake sleeping, I guess. So he begins shaking her awake and realizes that she's asleep. Jenny's mad that he's waking her up, asking, "What do you want?" But he realizes that wasn't her. So he goes back downstairs, sits down, continues trying to watch TV, sort of questioning what had just happened. When out of the corner of his eye, he sees a dark figure moving in the kitchen area. He runs in immediately, thinking he's going to catch somebody in this kitchen. He knows he saw it, but the kitchen is empty. Now Hunter is finally getting a glimpse of what Jenny had been living with for months. And after months of not believing her, he finally does, but decides not to talk to her about it. Still trying to hold on to the idea that this was the ideal house for them, and he made the right decision by picking it. One morning, Jenny goes to meet up with Kim at the Coosa County Courthouse researching the history of the home. And they find something. They're able to track down records that there was a family, but the last name Maxwell, who owned the land that the house sits on in the 1940s. So Jenny is hopeful that Maxwell This last name will lead her to answers about the house, and boy does it. She searches the name on the computer and finds tons of articles about William Maxwell, a local preacher. He was well known and feared in the community. In the 1970s, he was a preacher at the church just down the road from the house. Story goes, there were rumors in the town that he was involved in numerous mysterious deaths in Rockford. All of the victims? His family members. What happened next sounds less like a true crime case and more like something out of a Southern Gothic novel. In this research, she finds that on August 20th, 1977, hundreds of mourners packed into a funeral home and chapel in Alexander City, Alabama. They had gathered to say goodbye to 16-year-old Shirley Ann Ellington, the stepdaughter of local preacher Willie Maxwell. Standing before this crowd, Maxwell delivered the eulogy himself, but as the service came to an end, a man suddenly stepped forward from among the mourners. His name was Robert Burns, Shirley's uncle. Without warning, Burns pulled out a handgun and fired at point-blank range, striking Maxwell in the head. According to witnesses, Burns shouted that Maxwell had murdered Shirley and declared, "You're going to pay for it." The shooting unfolded in front of nearly 600 stunned onlookers, and Willie Maxwell died almost instantly. For many in the community, this killing wasn't viewed as a random act of violence. Instead, an explosive climax to years of suspicion. By the time of his death, state investigators had begun to view Maxwell as the prime suspect in the death of Shirley Ann Ellington. And according to investigators, her case may have only been one piece in a much larger pattern. Authorities suspected Maxwell could have been connected to as many as four other mysterious deaths over an eight-year period. In each case, insurance money was believed to be the possible motive. The circumstances surrounding Shirley's death were troubling. Just 1 week before Maxwell was shot, 16-year-old Shirley Ann Ellington had supposedly died in a tragic accident while changing a tire on a rural road in Coosa County. The initial story was that a car had somehow fallen and crushed her. But when an autopsy was performed, investigators made a shocking discovery. According to the lead state investigator, Shirley had already been dead before her body was placed beneath the vehicle. And what first appeared to be a freak accident was now being treated as a possible homicide. And at the center of it all stood Willie Maxwell, a self-proclaimed minister, a man rumored to practice voodoo, and a figure many locals had feared for years. As investigators dug deeper into Shirley Ann's death, they began to notice something disturbing. Shirley wasn't the first person connected to William Maxwell to die under mysterious circumstances. In fact, she was the fifth. Over an eight-year period, multiple members of Maxwell's family had died on isolated roads throughout Coosa County. And on the surface, each death appeared unrelated. A car accident here, an unexplained illness there, a body discovered along a rural highway. But there was one detail investigators could not ignore. In nearly every case, a life insurance policy was waiting to be collected. The first death occurred in 1969, when Maxwell's first wife, Mary Lou Maxwell, was found beaten and strangled inside her car. Authorities believed they had enough evidence to charge Maxwell with murder, but the case fell apart before trial. Why? Well, the state's key witness unexpectedly married Maxwell and later changed her testimony. Maxwell was acquitted. Then, in 1971, Maxwell's brother was found dead beside a remote roadway. His death was ruled the result of alcohol exposure, but years later, investigators began to wonder whether that conclusion had been mistaken. 2 years later, Maxwell's second wife was discovered dead inside her vehicle. Officials attributed her death to a severe respiratory illness, but Maxwell later attempted to collect a substantial double indemnity insurance payout by arguing her death had been accident-related. In 1976, Maxwell's nephew James Hicks was found dead after his car drifted off a rural highway. Medical examiners were unable to identify injuries serious enough to explain his death. And investigators would later discover that paperwork for Hicks's life insurance policy appeared to have been filled out in Maxwell's handwriting. By the summer of 1977, Shirley Ann Ellington had become the latest member of Maxwell's circle to die unexpectedly and mysteriously. For investigators, the similarities between the cases were becoming impossible to ignore. And some authorities wondered whether Willie Maxwell was more than just a con man or insurance fraudster. They suspected he could be something far more sinister, a serial killer hiding in plain sight. Now, no court ever proved that Maxwell was responsible for the deaths. Before the investigation could move any further, someone took matters into their own hands. Robert Burns, pulling the trigger, shooting and killing Willie Maxwell. Now, this was a big case. It became local, then national news. As we covered, Jenny finds out that Harper Lee, the well-known author from Alabama, was researching into Reverend William Maxwell for a true crime book. She even spent time in Rockford as she was researching and looking into the case. Locals called him the voodoo preacher. And it's strange and unknown why Harper Lee never published this book. Was it finished? What happened during her research? This is all a mystery. Now back to the house. It was said that Willie Maxwell's home sat vacant for years after his death and developed a reputation for paranormal activity. Locals claimed lights appeared on inside despite the house being empty. And some believe Maxwell's spirit never left the property. Jenny's trying to piece all of this together, this connection to William Maxwell, the haint blue at the house, the talk of voodoo. She gets home later this day from researching and is doing some housework on the second floor. Her daughter Grayson is in her bedroom coloring, and from downstairs, Jenny hears the phone ringing. She assumes it's Hunter, her husband, so she turns to go down the stairs, and as she's about to walk down, she gets that feeling again like someone is right behind her. Suddenly, she feels a violent push from behind her, and Jenny is shoved down the staircase, face first. She lands at the bottom, and she's in pain. When Hunter gets home, she tells him about what happened, and he finally believes her, and they make an agreement to leave as soon as the lease is up. Lease is up? I mean, I would have already been gone, but they're going to wait it out. Jenny is glad to know that at least there is an end date to this. They only had 1 month left. So in this time, Jenny continues searching for answers, looking deeper into the preacher William Maxwell and the articles about the case and voodoo. And she finds that many of the strange occurrences in the house are tied to voodoo. Bug infestations are common voodoo curses. It's believed that mirrors can be doorways to the dead. And as we know, all the mirrors had been removed from the house when they moved in. And Jenny sees something that stuck out to her. The voodoo spirit, named Boo Hag, is this vampire-like entity that will come into your room at night and sit on your chest and steal your life energy. Jenny's wondering if this entity, Boo Hag, was conjured up by Willie Maxwell. Is this that darkness, this evil presence in this home? Because something sticks out to her. After Boo Hag will come and sit on your chest and steal your life force, it will run up into the attic where it hides and lives. When they first moved in, Jenny remembers that attic door being duct taped shut with blue tape. And she had removed this tape and opened up the door that first day they got there. She wonders, is this the dark entity that has been tormenting the house and her family? And then we get to the most terrifying night in the house. Late one evening, everyone was asleep, except Jenny. She had finally got herself into bed, closed her eyes, and began drifting off to sleep. She's exhausted. And suddenly, she heard that scurrying, shuffling sound. She opens her eyes, and in the darkness of the room, she can make out a dark shape quickly moving towards her. She's watching and realizing what's happening. She said she can't move to get Hunter's attention or help. She's paralyzed. And within seconds, this dark entity has jumped onto the bed, crawled up, and is on top of her chest. This was a full attack. Jenny believes that this is how it ends for her. And again, this entire time, she cannot move a muscle. Then she sees the entity jump off and run down the hall, and she knows it's going after her daughter. And before she can even get out of bed, she hears Grayson screaming from down the hall. Jenny, finally able to move, jumps up and runs down the hall into her daughter's room to find her daughter terrified. Hunter's woken up and has run in, and they see there are three red claw marks down Grayson's neck. Fearing for their lives, they packed up and left the house the next morning. Jenny believes there is something truly evil in that house and wonders what happened to Harper Lee's research into Willie Maxwell, the voodoo preacher. Did she look too deep into it as well and become disturbed and haunted by what she found? The actual address of the house is pretty hard to track down. We know the area, Coosa County, but the exact house address hasn't been listed. But in local papers and media, I read that the house has been sitting empty for years, probably for the best. I gotta know, what are your thoughts on this haunting? Which part of the story creeped you out the most? I have a hard time picking just one because this entire thing is so scary. Next episode, I've got so much more mystery and eeriness coming your way. Make sure you're following along wherever you get this podcast. And if you're digging these episodes, leave a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps grow the show so I can continue bringing you the stories you love. And I want to remind everyone, if you are ever in the mood to watch these episodes, you can. Link is in the show notes. You can watch every single Avery After Dark episode on YouTube. I want you guys to have that choice. If you're at home and you want to sit back and have that visual experience, you can watch the show, curl up with a blanket and some snacks. But if you're on the go, you can listen to each episode. And if you want bonus episodes of the show, join the Avery After Dark Patreon or memberships on YouTube. I just dropped a new bonus episode recently, and it's pretty spooky. I think you will love it. Thank you to all who have joined.
If you like your true crime, like you like your coffee,
Red Handed is the podcast for you.
It's dark, intense, and might just keep you up all night.
I'm Hannah.
I'm Saruti. And every week on Red Handed, we break down a different fascinating case.
From the most recent US trials everyone is obsessing over, like Brendan Banfield, Karen Reed, and Ellen Greenberg,
to the most unbelievable stories from around the world, there's nothing we love more than digging into every detail of the cases we cover, getting beyond a basic analysis and cutting to the heart of the story.
Red Handed has over 400 episodes ready to binge right now.
Plus, be sure to check out our weekly sister show, Shorthand, where we unpack everything from the Black Death to Area 51.
If you're looking for smart, detailed true crime with personality, check out Red Handed wherever you get your podcasts.